Okay, Tony, so there's a number of things I guess we can get updated first, and then you can tell us about this little confab in Miami.
Yeah, and for us here in Nicaragua, the big event last week, there were lots of things going on, obviously, and if we have time, we should try and talk about President Trump's decision to reverse U.S. government policy on Cuba. But yeah. And for us at this meeting in Miami, which is probably not especially important from the U.S. government's point of view, but they did send Rex Tillerson to it to participate, and also Vice President Mike Pence was there.
Mm.
So from their point of view, you know, you have to ask, well, why are they sending out big guns like that to a relatively low-key conference to do with two or three small countries in Central America? And the reason seems to be that, and I perceive that as part of their offensive, their wider regional offensive against progressive governments in the region. And perhaps not so much targeting any particular government so much as reaffirming their policy of militarization and an insistence on what they would call market-based solutions to the region's problems.
Maybe you can give folks a little detail about what the actual meeting was and who was involved.
Yeah, and it was called the Conference on Security and Policy, and I've forgotten the exact title, but that was basically it for the Central American region. And it was the main participants were the presidents of what people call the Northern Triangle here in Central America, which consists of the three countries of El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. And those three countries traditionally have been strong U.S. allies. And El Salvador is the kind of the odd person out because they've been governed over the last 8 years now by the Farabundo Martí Liberation Front, which has been trying to implement progressive policies in a very adverse context, both nationally and regionally. But there were the three presidents, Juan Orlando Hernandez from Honduras, Jimmy Morales from Guatemala, and in fact, President Seren from El Salvador didn't go. He sent his vice president to represent El Salvador. And there were observer countries like Nicaragua was invited to observe, and they sent their foreign minister, Dennis Moncada, to participate. And that was quite interesting because there was an interaction, albeit not in the foreground of the meeting. There was an interaction between Nicaragua's representatives, Rex Tillerson, and U.S. representatives. And it has to be said that at a diplomatic level, here in Nicaragua, and the local U.S. diplomats, the ambassador Laura Dogu and her team, they seem to enjoy, you know, personally very good relationships with the Nicaraguan government. So there's a bit of a mismatch between the kind of propaganda that appears in North American media and Western European media about Nicaragua's relationship with the United States, because on one level it's quite good, and on another level you have this legislation being pushed through the U.S. Congress, the so-called NECA Act, which is an attempt to deny Nicaragua access to international development funding from major development finance institutions like the World Bank and the IMF, for example. But within that meeting, it was very clear that that was happening on the sidelines. That interaction between Nicaragua and representatives of the U.S. government was happening on the sidelines. The main item on the agenda was a consolidation by Rex Tillerson that was very clearly represented in his statement, to the conference in the closing session of the conference, stressing that the United States believed that prosperity was the solution to Central America's problems, for which, from the US government's point of view, the region requires strong emphasis on market solutions, investment, foreign direct investment from the private sector, and also a Colombianization of the region's military and security arrangements, because the rhetoric from the US government is that Colombia has been a huge success story over the last 15 years. Which is a complete joke, of course, because Colombia is the country that it's the biggest exporter of cocaine, certainly to the North American market and possibly to the European market too. And so to suggest that US policy in Colombia and US government accompaniment of the Colombian authorities has been successful in that regard is ridiculous. And if you start talking about why has Colombia managed to stabilize its security situation in terms of the 60-year-old civil war, almost 60 years old civil war, that is not due to US policy, which has been completely counterproductive until about 2013. But because Hugo Chavez and Fidel Castro and their colleagues in the region managed to convince both sides in Colombia that a peaceful settlement to the conflict was in the best interests of everybody. And the US government, for its own reasons, have tagged along with that. But it can't be said that they were protagonists of the original idea or the original impetus towards a peaceful resolution of the conflict in Colombia, far from it. So now, now what they're saying is that they're suggesting that their failed policy in Colombia is the recipe for success and security and prosperity in Central America, certainly in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador. And it was interesting that Mexico was one of the leading participants in the program as well.
Yeah, they were co-conveners. They were co-conveners along with the U.S.
Yeah. So what does that tell you? What that tells you is that the United States government is trying to enlist Mexico's also failed policies. A catastrophic failure in Mexico in terms of prosperity and security for the people of Mexico. And it's very weird, but and it's obviously bound to fail. You know, and they are not going to reduce migration from those Central American countries to the United States via Mexico with the policy mix that they're insisting they're going to impose. And what one sees there is the traditional kind of narcissism, if you like, of the United States authorities and their ridiculous adhesion to failed policies. They're doubling down on policies that have failed for the last 20 years.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, there's a statement at the White House website, whitehouse.gov, statement on the Conference on Prosperity and Security in Central America and the 47th General Assembly of the OAS. And it begins with, President Donald J. Trump commends Mexico for its leadership in co-convening the conference. And it ends with, the president also affirms the importance of the 47th General Assembly of the OAS taking place in Cancun, starting today, actually. He remains greatly concerned about the situation faced by the Venezuelan people and has instructed Tillerson to collaborate with countries to move the discussions forward on Venezuela. And he stands with the people of Venezuela during these sad and troubling times. Well, of course, the sad and troubling times are that this economic squeeze that's been put on the country for years now by the United States that has been re-enabled by President Trump after being enabled by Bush and Obama, including Obama and Trump, with executive orders declaring Venezuela to be a threat to the national security of the United States. So you talk about it being, you know, that way. I mean, it's that way in spades.
Yeah, and I think it's a further confirmation of the way that Donald Trump has completely folded to the military and foreign, the defense, if you like. And that's a joke in the United States, right, to talk about their military establishment as a defense establishment. And they've imposed, along with their colleagues in the State Department, with whom they're so often fighting. But they're in agreement that the United States has to maintain and intensify its interventionist policy, which Donald Trump promised that he would refrain from advancing.
No more regime change. Yeah. Yep, he said no more regime change. And what do you call toppling a government in Caracas if it's not regime change?
Yeah, and also the very disturbing reversal of U.S. government policy against Cuba, because although personally, and along with many other people, I was extremely skeptical of Barack Obama's change of policy, and all he was doing was acknowledging 50 years of failure and taking a new approach that he would achieve the same end. The policy objective, the strategic policy objective, didn't change with Obama's change of policy.
Right.
The objective continues to be to overthrow the legitimate government of Cuba that enjoys tremendous support from the Cuban population.
Right.
And so, and what Donald Trump is doing is simply caving into pressure from the fascists, right wing, based in Miami, but also more broadly, the fascist ideology that has a safe home in Florida's Southern Command, SOUTHCOM.
Yeah.
And also, it's worth pointing out that I've forgotten his name. Is it General John Hedges, one of the top brass down in SOUTHCOM? He was a key figure in this conference for security and prosperity in Central America last
week. He's now actually the head of Homeland Security. We're talking about Kelly.
Okay. Yeah. So that tells you a lot. If somebody like that guy, is it Kelly?
John Kelly. John Kelly is the Secretary of Homeland Security under this administration.
Right. Yeah. So the fact that somebody who was previously one of the, if not the general in command of SOUTHCOM, is now the head of Homeland Security, tells you how far down the road towards fascism the United States government is now heading.
Well, you know, I don't know that they really had to travel very far from where they've been for a good long time. When you speak in terms of policy,
they're becoming more and more shameless in the way they implement it.
Yeah, that's a tough one too, but okay. they've been pretty shameless.
Don, it's interesting for us here to get the take from. It's always interesting for us to get the take of what progressives and radicals in the United States think about these kinds of developments. And how effective do you think lobbying from progressive and radical movements in the States will be to kind of mitigate what Trump seems to have in mind for Cuba?
Well, a couple things. From my point of view, I can't speak for anyone else, but, this for myself and my opinion formed from speaking with others here and elsewhere. If you're looking at Cuba, of course, and I went to Cuba under the Obama changes, the significant change which is remaining is the establishment of diplomatic relations, formal diplomatic relations. That was a significant change, at least in terms of structural changes, formal structures. And that isn't being affected, at least not yet. Trump hasn't threatened to do anything about that. Practice-wise, the change was that in addition to the other permitted categories for Americans to travel to Cuba, which included like academic or business or whatever the things were, within the sanctions regime, but whatever, were sort of government to government or, commerce to commerce or education, et cetera. Those were permitted. They added people-to-people exchanges, and the definition of it was the most, you know, the lowest order. In other words, if I went there and said hello to somebody, then I fulfilled my obligation, which allowed me to have a visa to go. So, which is what I did. That is now being removed. So the other scenarios that people used to have to cook up to visit from the United States, you know, we're going to go meet with an educational group, or we're going to go meet with a social organization, or, you know, we're going to meet with a medical association, whatever, you know, that's what they'll have to do again. So that's, in terms of material change, that's what's proposed. In the United States, you know, you have a lot of folks that have an entirely different perception of what, you know, happened under Obama and what's happening under Trump that, you know, doesn't really deal with the fact pattern that I just gave you. So the response to what Trump is doing has to be measured against that perceptual, you know, the perceptual inaccuracy that Obama normalized relations with Cuba and now Trump is going back to where it was before. Well, first of all, they haven't normalized them. The embargoes are still, you know, firmly in place. That hasn't changed. You know, you're going to go visit someone in Havana, for example. Perhaps you want to bring a toilet seat or some other things that are just difficult to get, because on an island with 6 million people, you can't manufacture every little thing on the island and be surrounded by the U.S. Navy and Air Force and stuff and say, okay, well, toilet seats, we'd like to buy them from China like everybody else in the world. No, you can't. Well, you know, some people then have to go without them because they don't have a toilet seat factory in Havana. They've got every other damn thing you could possibly want, but some simple things like that, that remains. That's the point. That has never been removed. People were pushing to have sanctions takedowns while Obama was president, and he didn't do it. He refused to do it. So Trump hasn't, you know, he's making moves to make it look like it's even less likely that that will happen. But I think that there's a policy consistency there that is kind of hidden from the view of Americans. And so, again, their perception of what's happening colors their response. But it also shows a truth that if Americans knew what was happening for all of the last 50 or 60 years, they might have been as angry at Obama and Bush and Clinton and Bush as they are at Trump, because the fact pattern is essentially the same. And as you point out, the strategic objective has been the same pretty much since January 1st, 1959. You know? Yeah. So that's, you know, how I read it as far as Cuba goes. In the larger picture, the one
and
thing,
so much of what you said applies to Venezuela as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does, exactly. And the whole. And here's the thing that this is something that Professor Tony Montero points out when we discuss these things, and when I've seen him discuss them with Glenn Ford and others, and that is that, you know, there's this perception here that fascists were elected in November of last year, which rests on the assumption that fascists run for election and that they have to be elected to office. Well, John Kelly has been in the U.S. government for something like 40 years, and he was head of Southcom. Excuse me. You know, he was a commanding general of the multinational force in Iraq from 2008 to 2009 for a year. Right. He was the head of the of another group there until October of 2009. He became head of Southcom in November 2012, and he was there till this past January, and now he's head of Homeland Security. So this fascist is now head of Homeland Security. That shows that fascists came into power on January 20th, or was it when he was a fascist in charge of the Western Hemisphere south of El Rio Grande, appointed by Obama there, and he was a fascist occupying Iraq before that, appointed by Bush. The fascists have been in power for a very long time here.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the thing.
And from my point of view, and I think, and some people get hung up on the use of the term fascist, but for me, there's a very it's shorthand for a very simple phenomenon, political phenomenon, which is the marriage of corporate power with political military power.
Right.
And that's been the case in the United States for Well, as long as I can remember.
You might say July 4th, 1776, or, sometime in 1789, 1790, when they passed the, the Constitution was finally enacted and, it went into effect. Or, certainly, any other point subsequent, 1945, you have corporate power driving an awful lot of global policy, with that corporate power resting here in the United States and being projected through the U.S. military. And it's been pretty much that way since then. I mean, the people in the Philippines have been experiencing it since 1898, as have the people in Puerto Rico.
Right.
So I don't think this is a new phenomenon at all.
No, and there's that famous quote from Henry Wallace, who was a vice presidential candidate back at the end of the Second World War, wasn't he? And his quote was, the American fascist doesn't work in an overt way, but they work to poison the channels of information.
Mm, yeah.
And I think that's a very... it's worth a very relevant quote back from what's that now, 70 years ago?
Yeah, and you're talking about a period, immediately, that statement followed immediately by like the Hollywood 10 and other, purging of the apparatus of communications that if what Wallace says is true, people said, oh, you're right, let's take care of that. And they went in and fascists took over and ran everybody out that didn't share their particular view of world affairs.
Right.
Joe McCarthy and
getting back to Venezuela, as you mentioned earlier, there's this very important in a way, and it's significant meeting of the Organization of American States, the Assembly of Organization of American States. And so, although Venezuela took the decision some months ago to leave the Organization of American States, that process takes 2 years. And Delcy Rodriguez, the Venezuelan foreign minister, has taken advantage of that to participate in this meeting today, which again, despite the Organization of American States' own rules, have the Secretary General or the Director General of the OAS, Luis Almagro, took it upon himself to set the agenda. And with the support of right-wing governments like those of the United States and Mexico and Peru and others, Argentina, they set the agenda to talk about Venezuela's internal affairs, which is completely against the norms and procedures of the Organization of American States. And then Delcy Rodriguez is going to be in that meeting. And I think sparks will fly because she's not going to be muted in her condemnation of what the other countries are trying to do to Venezuela. And I've been trying to follow events there as best I can. And from what I can gather, there's a solid block of around 14 countries, including the ALBA countries and the CARICOM countries, the Caribbean Community countries, that make it impossible for the moment for Luis Almagro and the United States and their allies to advance their agenda to try and isolate Venezuela and apply and get the Organization of American States to apply sanctions within the region. That's what Almagro and his masters and mistresses in the U.S. government are trying to bring about, because so far the United States has applied sanctions, but other countries like Peru, Brazil, Argentina, Chile, for example, Colombia, Mexico, they can't apply sanctions against Venezuela except bilaterally. And that's the importance of this meeting today. So one of the interesting developments is that, I don't know if you saw this news item, at the beginning of last week, apparently there was a demonstration in Antigua and Barbuda by people trying to force the government in Antigua and Barbuda to call new elections. Now, I view that, I might be completely mistaken in this, but I superficially at any rate, what that looks like is an attempt by the United States and its allies to manipulate opinion, certainly in Antigua and Barbuda, but in the Caribbean generally, so as to bring about a change in policy on the part of the CARICOM countries.
Right.
And so let's see how that develops, because if they can break CARICOM and get the Caribbean island nations to support the line being promoted by Luis Almagro and his accomplices, then that will probably very likely lead to the breakup of the OAS as we know it, because of the ALBA countries will not accept that. When the ALBA countries, what are we talking about? We're talking about Ecuador, Bolivia, Nicaragua, and there's something like five or six Caribbean island nations that are members of ALBA, and they're very unlikely to accept a formal decision by the OAS to impose sanctions on Venezuela. So and this meeting today for the OAS is not a make or break meeting, but it's a very important meeting in terms of setting down markers for what we can expect in the future.
Yeah, you know, you have 35 members. So what's the size of the block you mentioned right now that includes 14, the CARICOM?
14 countries.
Right. Okay, so that means that the vote is going to be like 19 to 14 or something, 21 to 14, somewhere in there, depending on, because they've had abstentions too.
Am I right, Don, in thinking that under OAS rules they need a two-thirds majority to approve the kinds of sanctions that they're pushing for?
I'm not sure, because the list of sanctions has, it's been shifting as the U.S. has been trying to find something that'll pass. But you have another situation, which Cuba, first of all, got... They didn't get expelled, but their government was told you can't represent Cuba here. So, in essence, you could come watch and not really observe, but you can't do anything because we don't really recognize you as Cuba's government. It was almost like that. And that was in 1962. And in 2009, Obama, I guess, said, okay, well, let's let them back in. So I guess they had a scenario envisioned like the one they've been running against Venezuela now. Cuba said, yeah, thanks, no thanks. And so everybody in the region is a member, but not everyone is a full member. And then, so out of that 35, they count Cuba with note one, for example, has chosen not to resume participation.
Yeah, and it's also worth bearing in mind, Don, that the so-called conservative restoration is a very transitory phenomenon. It's not. It's a very flimsy, frail phenomenon. And so
let's go to Argentina on that. Well, we got a few minutes because that may be about to manifest pretty deeply.
Yeah, and the because it seems to me that the OAS and the U.S. government, in so many ways, not just in Latin America, but around the world. And the U.S. government has a window of opportunity of maybe 3, maximum 4 years before their options become much more restricted than they are at the moment. Because what's likely to happen is that it's likely that in the elections, Honduras has elections later this year. And it's likely that all the signs are that the now united Honduran opposition will defeat the entrenched power of the Honduran elites represented by Juan Orlando Hernandez. They nearly did it in 2013 when the Libre Party came ever so close to defeating the political representation of the Honduran oligarchy. And now that they've united with a couple of independent parties, it looks as though that they're very, very likely to win the election later this year. In Chile, it's likely that Michelle Bachelet's kind of neoliberal light government is going to be replaced by a hard neoliberal government under Sebastián Piñera again, who was he couldn't stand for re-election last time, but he's he was the president of Chile before Bachelet, and he's standing for re-election, and it looks extremely likely that he'll get back in. So we'll probably have another hardline Chilean government working with the right-wing governments of Colombia, Peru, and Mexico against Venezuela. But in Argentina and Brazil next year, and all the signs are that if, and it's a big if in Brazil there are legitimate elections, the Workers' Party leader, Lula Ignacio da Silva, is likely to win those. And that'll be a dramatic change in the region's overall balance of power, because Lula is a strong supporter of the Alba government and a strong supporter of Venezuela under Nicolas Maduro. And also in Argentina, it looks as though in the legislative elections this year, assuming that right-wing gerrymandering is kept to a minimum, that Cristina Fernandez's new political alliance will do very well in the legislative elections and bring more pressure to bear on Mauricio Macri's government. So I don't think Macri's up for re-election until 2019, unfortunately. But it's likely that the regional configuration, the balance of power between progressive and right-wing governments, is likely to shift dramatically in favor of the progressive movement for anti-neoliberal policies, progressive policies promoting the interests of the majorities, all too often the impoverished majorities in Latin America. And so the United States government and its allies and Luis Almagro have really only got about, 9 months, nine months to a year in order to achieve their objectives, because once that time's up, things will look very different and they'll be much less favorable for their repressive agenda against Venezuela.
And we have to stop it there, but certainly if Brazil goes the way that you suspect, there will also be a firming up of its relationship with the other BRICS countries, and perhaps maybe more of a willingness of China, Russia, India, and South Africa to involve itself in protecting these governments here in the Western Hemisphere. So,
yeah, maybe we can talk about that next time.
Yeah, we will definitely. All right, Tony, thank you very much. It's a pleasure as always.
Okay, likewise.